Welcome to The Brilliant. This is going to be episode, I believe it's going to be 62. And this is basically, we're doing about a half dozen episodes to close out our series of conversations around technology, the concept being to maintain this theme of technology. And really what I'm looking for or hoping for is to meet with some people who might have some ideas as to what it would look like to have a updated critique of technology, basically since Gerrymander and John Zerzan and the authors from the 80s, who sort of, when ecological arguments were sort of first being made in a more mainstream context, made their critiques of technology. It seems that nowadays there is not necessarily a lot of big thinking from an anti-authoritarian place around the topic. So anyway, so this is the fourth in the series on the topic. There probably are going to be about six altogether. And today I'm talking with Rydra.
Hello, Aragorn.
Hello. So Rydra and I do know each other personally, and so that's probably going to infect this conversation. Because my hope is that we actually have some actual disagreements. In general, Rydra is a joker, and so never actually gets down to brass tacks in terms of where disagreement lies. And obviously, some people make the same criticism of me. So hopefully, this will be a place where, you know, hinging on this particular topic, we can talk about some places where we disagree. Our first pass on this, why don't you talk a little bit about how you came to a green anarchist perspective and how you articulate your perspective today?
Well, I came to a green anarchist perspective before I'd even met another anarchist, just happenstance of liking to be in bookstores and happenstance of finding fucking John Zerzan of all people. And
well,
so
you started with John.
He was the first like real anarchist book, the first nonfiction anarchist book I read. So I'd read The Dispossessed and some other stuff that had been moving me in that direction. It was just straight up Elements of Refusal. I read the book and I was like, you know, I was dating a socialist at the time and who was an artist. And I was like, you can't do this art thing anymore. Because you know how I am with a book. Once I first read the book, I wear the book completely. So I was like, I don't know about this art thing.
I'm suspicious
literally
of the symbolic gestures you're making.
The conversations between us were literally like, you need to read this essay before you keep drawing things. I'm concerned about you right now.
Funny. It was his examination of symbolic thought.
Yeah, the symbolic thought, for sure.
And why do you think that you were fertile ground for that?
Probably more books. I read Ishmael when I was like 18.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
That really is like a
anarchist book, for sure. It's an anti-civ book, if not
for sure.
Directly anti-civ book, for sure. Even though whatever. It's weird in many ways. He's a weird guy. But, that definitely was like sitting latent in my mind. Mm-hmm. But there's been a lot of stuff that's latent in my mind too. Like, especially as I get older and go back, I've been rereading a lot of the books I read in my late teens, early 20s, which is, you know, about 15 years ago now. And so even as I recently reread all of Kundera's books. So it's been interesting where I'm like, oh shit, I didn't even realize I was reading like mega deep, interesting nihilist stuff when I was not even, I hated nihilism and just the idea of not having meaning, creating change back then. But somehow I read that and still appreciated it. I was just like, it wasn't even so much that I missed the point. It was that I couldn't access it or something.
No, absolutely. Your mind, you know, does change over the years and what you're able even to conceive of at point A in your life is absolutely different than at point B.
Oh yeah, totally. That's why when I think about being young and like giving young people certain books, it depends, yeah. You know?
Like, I actually don't give people Letters of Insurgence until they've sort of run through all of the ideas and they're kind of exhausted and they're looking for something to re-energize them, because this book will either suffocate the flame entirely or entirely re-energize them, because it's so clear that the path that they've traveled is the same path that's been traveled time and time again, you know, and similar to, you know, similar to other books, Society of the Spectacle, I wouldn't give to someone until they were, you know, had really checked out some other stuff.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot more sense to try to figure out what people have read and like where they're, even where they're like latent things that have been like placed in them. Cause like we all know the latent stuff that culture places in people,
sure.
But like the stuff people actually choose is pretty important too.
So you read John Zerzan's book,
yeah.
And that's at the point in your life where you started to reach out and find other anarchists, or did that happen later?
oh, I just felt totally and completely alone. I was like, who else holds these ideas? Like, I don't even know anarchists. Now, who am I going to find that's a green anarchist? I had no idea what was going on.
So you didn't find any, your next step wasn't the internet.
Yeah. I've never been like a big, like, I still don't really know how to navigate Reddit. Like, I'm just not a great computer person because I haven't put the time into it. So for me,
it's not how your mind works.
Yeah. It's not how my mind works. Like going through the message boards and stuff. Like I've learned how to do A-news, even though like I still can't figure out who's replying to who. And I don't know if that's me or the website. It's probably just me because I still can't figure it out on Reddit either. But
it's a little bit of both.
Okay. But yeah, it's not how my mind works. Generally, I like arguing about things. Like that's where I find the most value is. Sure. And you know how I do things where I argue with people and I like probably just end up yelling at them a lot. And then I go home and it takes me a few weeks. And finally, whatever they said sinks in. Like I don't usually tell the people that I was wrong, but it'll come back out when I say other things.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting mostly because that is, I guess, ostensibly a pre-internet way of engaging with ideas and grappling with them. And part of the positive consequence of that, of course, is that, you know, it makes you engaged face to face. You know, a lot of people who we have come around, they're not that engaged. It's very strange, you know, where you have these relationships with people, especially, you know, on places like Facebook, where they're absolutely engaged in the topics that you're interested in, they're super present. Then you meet them face to face, and they basically don't say a word.
Yeah, I don't get. There's a lot of stuff I don't really understand around that. I guess it's just trying to relate to others in general. Because for me, it just if I'm interested in something, it's like when I get a chance to talk about it, it's gonna be fucking awesome. Especially like being isolated for so long, I wanted these conversations for so long. And then even now living in Santa Cruz, it's like when I come up to the Bay or something, or when I have a friend visit me, or like when I have one or the two basically interesting people I know in Santa Cruz, when I hang out with them, it's like, we go at it hard because we don't get it that often, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you know, this of course is a place where I'm incredibly spoiled. So
what I was just thinking is anytime you want access to these conversations, you have it face to face.
Yeah. And it's also one of the advantages, frankly, of the nature of the compound. I'm not cheek to jowl with people who I would like to talk about interesting ideas with, which means I don't have the sort of hidden roommate resentments.
Yeah.
That a lot of times prevent good conversations from happening in anarchist households. And, you know, because I just don't have that roommate problem. So instead, you know, when I want to talk, we actually can sit down and talk.
Yeah, this is why the warehouse, when I moved into the warehouse, Fuse was so valuable because I was living with, 13 people who are interested and at least vaguely interested. And like most of them had read more of hadn't read more in general, but had read more of the like of anarchist material than I had.
Yeah. I mean, this is really, you know, one of the reasons why the Bay Area is sort of starting to fade as an anarchist center is because, I mean, there are almost no warehouses left. And I mean, the Oakland group house scene, I'm not sure it has anything going on right now. I mean, I know that there's still a couple artists. Sure.
Spaces. It's like queer spaces or something, which is, I mean, it's hard, you know, whatever. It's, we critique that boring paradigm all the time, so we just leave it at that.
Yeah, but it is a shame because really group houses is a place where these ideas ferment, where, you know, the energy for the projects come out of.
Well, just look at Bastard a few years ago, and there's like four people from my house presenting, and then none of us have presented since then.
Yeah, I think that I'm... Yeah, whatever. I for many years, I haven't held any hope for the Bay Area as a place where anything's going to happen.
Sure.
You know, it's a big city, and most of the people who are here are surviving more than anything else. I mean, you do get exposure to cultural artifacts here in a way that you don't in other places, and obviously to older, interesting people.
Well, but when I look at my best friends in the Bay, like who you know, like probably my four closest friends up here are all people that are relevant to you, and all of them are, I work 10 hours a week and that's it. Like that is it. And all these people, they work at least 40 hours a week. And that doesn't even include all the other like commitments they have to fucking shit, like a dog or like a partner or, you know, voluntary stuff that even is, you know, they're fucking busy. It's crazy. It's absurd. Like I personally can't live like that. So it's hard to find. And even when you do find time with those people, it's hard for a lot of that not to be conversations about what they're doing most of the time, which is generally not that interesting.
Well, ostensibly, the reason that you left the Bay Area was to have a lifestyle like that.
Yo, for sure. Yeah. Yeah. Cause I had it in the bay until we got kicked out of the warehouse. Then when you're not finding rent under $900, what are you going to, like, that's not for me. You know, that's, that lifestyle of work is not for me.
So there's probably an elegant way to transfer this conversation into one about technology, but we'll do it rough.
Okay.
Which is to say that, you don't seem to use a lot of like labor saving or time saving devices. I mean, obviously we're talking about, using a computer, but, you know, by and large, your thought wasn't to take advantage, for instance, of the huge number of computer jobs there are in the Bay Area.
Yeah, it was, well, I mean, a lot of that is just leftism, where when I was thinking about jobs through most of my early 20s, I was helping people.
Right. You more or less had a social work background.
Yeah, social work. I was a teacher, special ed teacher. And even when the last thing I did when I quit my social work job was volunteer for 2 years at a domestic violence crisis center for no money. Like, it took a while for me to, like, let that leave.
And I guess your future doesn't hold any... I mean, like, it's weird to talk about the career part of our lives in the context of technology. I guess not so weird since my career is in technology, but... Right. But you know, it is difficult for me to think, you know, when I talk to most of my peers who don't work in the same industry that I do, that I guess almost everybody else who doesn't work in technology doesn't have much hope for a job. Like, like you're a fairly precarious person in the kind of labor that you do. You know, obviously we have a middle school teacher who's nearby us. Mm-hmm. Like, there are, you know, we have a union organizer person who's nearby us, but we don't, like, there just aren't that many stable jobs, I guess, or it feels like that's the case.
Yeah, I guess I'm sort of lucky in a way that I have, like, these, like, basically specialized kid skills where I can, like, work in these little weird ways with kids, like, where I'll get paid twice to three times as much as what a normal person who does the part-time labor stuff they do. Because, so, like, I get paid $35 an hour at my job, which is why I don't have to work that much, even though I'm... At the end of the day, when I only work what I work out, it comes out to like something like at most like $1,400 or $1,500 a month. So being in that situation is a little more helpful for me than like, so for instance, if I was getting paid $18 an hour, I'd be totally fucked right now, you know?
Oh, just because the number of hours.
Yeah. I'd have to literally work over two times what I'm working right now.
Sure.
Yeah. Which would change everything.
Yeah. I mean, child stuff is interesting nowadays because it does seem like it's so, like, it's a desperate need for, like, the upper bourgeois or whatever to have
money and child. Well, yeah, and that's the weird part is if I want to get paid, I'm working for some seriously rich people.
Yeah.
Like, when I nannied in the city, I was working for this Latina businesswoman of the year who has managed all private wealth for Goldman Sachs on the West Coast. Like, she has more money than all of us will ever have in our lives. Yeah. 10 times over.
No, for sure. Yeah. But I mean, really what you're doing is you have to be appealing to a type of audience that's, that really is looking for a high-end childcare. They more or less are looking for, like, you know, after the school day is over, they want the education to continue.
For sure. But the weird niche I feel is that I'm just a weirdo in general, but I'm like a weirdo that, like, if I'm like just, I don't need to change myself too much to be okay with them. Like, I'm still weird to my kids. I still say weird things. I talk about time not existing. Like, I told one of my kids the other day, you know, I always talk about stupid shit. Like, why do you go to school? This is ridiculous. Should quit, you know, and the parents just think it's funny and then I'm cute, you know, it's harmless to them.
Well, I mean, really what you're doing is you're exposing them to a different worldview that they wouldn't necessarily be exposed to. And that is actually within the scope of what it is that these people who make big money.
Oh yeah, for sure. Cause there's more paths available than whatever.
Well, you have a college degree.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you learn to talk this way to some greater or lesser extent at the same place where they learned how to be specialists in the area that they're in.
Yeah, and the little kids are all super articulate little private school kids. They're, you know, it's pretty funny. A lot of them talk much more articulately than I do, and they're like 10.
And they're very confident.
And they're polite. Like, it's really, well, not all of them are polite. Some of them are little shits, but a lot of them are like so, like, well-behaved. It's shocking.
So Free Radical Radio, when it was a podcast, did seem to orient itself a lot around green anarchist topics. Yeah. I mean, I guess you didn't call it green anarchist, you called it anti-civ.
Yeah.
And I guess for you, what's the difference between a green anarchist perspective and an anti-civ perspective?
I mean, it almost boils down to that, like, what is now getting stale, like anarchy versus anarchism conversation, mm-hmm. where I guess I was actually reading that Julian Longer piece today, which I haven't read much he's written, so I don't really have much to say about it. But anyways, besides, he was actually talking about this exact thing of the green anarchy and the anti-civ. But I guess for Bellamy and I, it was more about like being less dogmatic about things, and that we still never had a plan. Like even in the beginning when we were both much different, like we still
didn't, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed.
Yeah, we still didn't have plan. We were smart enough to know we're idiots still, mm-hmm. you know? Like there was never a point where we could look around and think, well, at least I couldn't. I don't think he could either. Look around and think we could really tell people. Like the idea of the radio show wasn't to like share our perspective of the world. It was coming out of a place of deep loneliness. Like we met each other and didn't know anyone to talk to. Like we were searching out people all through Oakland to like do things we wanted to do and talk about things we wanted to talk about and have a closer range of ideas. And we couldn't even find anyone that was even willing to have the conversations with us, let alone participate in them in an interesting way. So it was literally a scream into the void, like someone respond, is anyone out there?
Sure. But you did, you know, you interviewed most of the names.
Oh, and, yeah, for
sure. Or at least some of the names in anti-civilization thought. And, you know, I'm just going to ask the same question again.
Yeah.
What for you was the difference between a green anarchist perspective and an anti-civ perspective?
Yeah. Okay. So when I think green anarchist, I wasn't around back when you were, when like Green Anarchy magazine was a thing and all that. So for me, I'm not as familiar with the whole trajectory of it, except for looking back. So when I think green anarchy, that's when I think like John Zerzan, environmental protesting, like even if it's non-leftism somehow, which I would still probably throw in there, but it's a whole trajectory of things like Zerzan, Kevin Tucker,
That's green anarchist to you.
That's kind of what I think of when I think about that. I guess I think of it as primitism basically. Mm-hmm. And then I guess there's some other people that get thrown in there too for me, but
as opposed to anti-civ.
To me, anti-civ is just literally looking outside and being like, no, not into it. And I think I was thinking about technology. I think that it feels kind of important to mention just like the basic premise under which I would ever talk about technology, which is, I think you might agree with, but I'll just state it, which would be that technology, at least in the way it manifests, just the basic, anytime I'm ever talking about it, it's under this connection to slavery that's going to always exist. So when I think about it, technology, I think about slavery. And then I think about the second part, which is the nihilist part, which is, and it's too big. I can't do anything. Like, I'm not going to fix it in my lifetime. So like getting rid of technology is not like part of my plan.
Interesting. I mean, I think I have perhaps a softer definition, whereas I would say that I think that technology is a way of organizing society and our activity rather than that it's just bad. In other words, I this is a place where I really agree with John.
Uh-huh.
I actually heard John give a presentation once, and it was like one of the times where I left being like, okay, I agree with that. Mm-hmm. Whereas almost any time I hear him talk in the anarchist space, I absolutely don't agree with him. But anyways, this was an audience at Stanford, and he basically talked about, you know, one of the first technologies was the idea of division of labor, and that idea. Mm-hmm. You know, that you are strong, you'll do the lifting. I'm smart, I'll do the thinking. Mm-hmm. And then obviously the gendered way in which division of labor is mostly experienced. Anyways, but to me, honestly, the definition aspect of this isn't all that interesting to me. Just so you understand my thinking around this, my issue at this point with an anti-civ perspective is that, you know, there is a trajectory of what we would call anti-civilization thought. And, you know, by and large, it would start with someone like a Freddie Perlman and not necessarily the ecological thinkers from the 60s or even Jeffers or, you know, a poet or Muir or like the founders of the environmental movement. They're not anti-civ. You know, anti-civ was specifically about the critique of civilization.
Yeah.
And so that's a distinct thing. It has a distinct arc. And so the reason that I use the term green anarchist, especially now, is because I'm interested in the entire scope of green anarchist thought, which, you know, again, also begins in the 19th century. So I'm I am somewhat interested in Reclus.
Yeah.
And basically the thinking that would go from Reclus, the Reclus brothers, all the way to Murray Bookchin, all of whom are under the umbrella of Green Anarchism, whether I agree with them or not, they're thinking about the same kind of problems mm-hmm. that I'm thinking about. But then obviously there's other currents and tighter definitions that live in the very big sky of Green Anarchism. One of those sects and the sect that obviously, you know, we're both identified with today would be anti-civilization thought, of which anarcho-primitivism is yet another subset underneath that. And so for me, I try to draw distinctions in these terms rather than like, I agree with this term and I disagree with this term.
Sure.
But instead, you know, just to be a bit more precise, to say that you know, for me, Green Anarchism is the big umbrella, and it's supposed to sound open and broad, and that's because for me, I'm not an ist,
right?
And I'm basically, how can one think about ideas and understand them clearly without being an ist? Because all the language that we have to talk about the complexity of our of these ideas and how they interplay with each other is ism kind of language. And you know, so for me, of course, my interest has always been in the interstitial spaces between these isms. But that doesn't mean that I don't recognize the cogs as they're fitting together and of course grinding us apart.
Yeah, it's tricky because on one level, like, I have this like love for like this like raw, passionate, like hardline stance. But you know, and I've played that out times in my life. But on the other side, like, you know, I'll read like Kundera say, the man of conviction is the man chaining himself to a fixed idea, and I'm like, fuck,
I can't deny it.
Yeah, I can't deny it. Like,
I mean, Stirner says the same sort of thing,
right? But like once you ist yourself, it's difficult.
Yeah,
and it's also, I guess people have a way when they say whatever ist they are, whether it's a fucking socialist or an anarchist, doesn't matter what it is they use, like where they have an idea, but it's you know, using that in conversation is so tricky. So I don't even know how I go about those things anymore, or I guess it makes more sense to talk about things. But I guess when I think of anti-civ too, I think the what I consider like a step past that or beyond that is what I'm more comfortable with now, which is just anti-society. Which mm-hmm. I think breaks it down on like a larger level where it's simpler, and I'm like, someone can says something to me and I'm like, that's nice that you have these plans and all that, but I'm not convinced that people can live in groups of 10,000 together. I don't know, man. I don't think that's a thing.
Or that the unifying force of that 10,000
can be an ideology.
Well, no, that unifying force is violence.
Oh yeah. Well, that's why I'm obsessed with this Michelle Saris stuff right now, is because he's saying that it's kind of the opposite.
Who is that?
He's a French philosopher who also writes
spelled last name
Serres. Okay. And he teaches at Stanford actually, but he doesn't teach in English, but he teaches in French. And it's almost impossible to find anything besides his translations in English. All his online videos and everything is in French. Really frustrating. But anyways, he challenges some of these notions of violence in the way that we see them, which I think are interesting, because he's like, he's really pro like a more primeval type of what, like he almost calls it like primitive violence, but he's smart enough not to fall into any traps about that, like any noble savage stuff. He doesn't even go there. He's not anthropological. Everything's from a completely subjective point of view, like based on what he's read. But it's interesting because he uses violence to explain like, to break down the entire theory, like class theory, basically, like all forms of Marxism or any way of looking at society and classes. He single-handedly wipes it off the map by talking about how the thing that creates the classes isn't violence, but the classes are created to stop violence, basically, if that makes sense.
So what's he best known for?
Oh, well, his critiques of language generally, specifically the French language.
What's the title?
I don't know the titles of those ones, but what I'm most interested in, what I think is most relevant to anarchists, is this book Genesis, basically, where it's a really hardcore critique of science in a really interesting way. And he holds up this.
And it's been translated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's been translated. It's so, actually free online in ARG.
So when he's talking about violence, but he's not being moralistic about it.
No.
But he's talking about the rise of civilization basically also being the constraint of violence, or the mm-hmm. or the specialized violence becoming the specialized category rather than something that happens in daily life.
Yeah, and he gets super into all of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
great topic.
It's super interesting the way he talks about it because.
And what's his discipline? What department does he?
Philosophy. In French language, but he's total. So he holds up like an arbitrary idea of the philosopher that I just like cancel out and put like reasonable person in for. But sure.
This is one of the problems. I have to admit, like, you know, philosophy is one of the few regions of you know, formal thinkers that where I have a lot in common with. I'd really like to talk to them. But as soon as they talk about themselves, I want to kill all of them. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just want to punch them forever. I was talking at the reading group this week about Partially Examined Life.
Right.
And basically just being totally infuriated with how the kind of arrogance they have, just being, ugh.
Well, I think that's the problem with any smart person. And I use that like pejoratively and I think it's a trap I fell into when I was younger too, once you're smart enough, you think you can make decisions for other people. And even if you think you can do that in a good way, like that's, not to make a Rick and Morty in reference, but I saw, one of the characters talking and they were talking about Rick and Morty. Why, like, what would it look like if he tried to like help the world? And I think Dan Harmon's was like, if Rick was trying to like make the world a better place, he would do so much more damage than he does just by being like a drunk nihilist mess, you know? And so I think those philosophers often fall into that problem, and it gets super boring because they'll get into like ethics and like trying to decide how to live. And I think those, like them having that conversation from wherever they're having it from, is so irrelevant. It's beyond ridiculous.
So I want to come back around. And of course, partially my role in these conversations is to bring the topic back around.
Sure. I will never do that.
The thing that both John and Kevin, especially when they talk to each other, they repeat this sort of concept over and over again, which is this idea that domestication is this real problem. And I think that for them, domestication is almost like the way in which they define technological apparatus today is sort of being implemented as domestication. And they seem to talk a lot about the problems of domestication, the fact that domestication exists. For me, I've never loved that word, but and it's hard for me to think about it outside of the concept of raising cows. Animals. And
I think cows anytime someone says it.
Well, on some level that's their intention, or I'm sure when they first started using the term that was their intention, because of course for them they're a lot more concerned about civilization as parsed through granaries and animal husbandry than they are concerned about civilization necessarily as specialization, because specialization is hard to talk about unless you start using examples. And you know, obviously farming has lots of examples but very few of us talk about the priesthood and the complexities of what it means to insert the priesthood into the daily life of regular people. How do you do that? That took many generations of very smart people scheming.
Yeah, a lot of planning.
Anyways, what's your thought about domestication? And maybe the other direction to take this in is to say, when did AP or anarcho-primitivism start to fall apart for you as being a useful way to see the world? Because obviously you at least put on John's coat for a little while.
Yeah. Oh no, for sure. When did it fall apart? I guess it fell apart for me once I started meeting people who had a critique of it, because I hadn't found.
What were the first critiques you heard? I mean, was it here in the Bay Area?
Yeah. Besides the ad hominem. I mean, I've heard critiques of it. I'm talking about critiques not from a position I've held. So that's like something I've tried to explain when I talk to people, is like, it's not really worthwhile for me to be critiqued from like a liberal perspective. I was a liberal at one point. I've already critiqued myself from that. It's interesting when I'm critiqued from someone else I don't understand basically where they're coming from. And that all happened in Oakland for sure. Because it was probably like, it was, well, also being in doing the radio for me was awesome, because I got to talk about things every week and have these conversations. And you know, sometimes you have them and you're in the middle of it and you're just like, fuck, I'm sick of hearing myself talk about this shit. Like, what, you know?
Anyways.
Oh yeah. So I would.
The first critiques you heard that sort of make sense? That.
So I guess it's a combination of that, hearing myself talk about things. And I think anytime I talk about any idea for long enough, I eventually get so bored of myself talking about it that I'll like try to fight it myself. But So the first critiques that I was hearing were the basic ones, like Christianity, like Eden, like back to the mm-hmm. back to the primitive state, and then like maybe it was actually not how they said it was, anthropology, like all those. Basically, all the critiques that I would level now, most of them at least, I heard pretty much at the same. Like, it wasn't like one thing. People were just like sitting me down and being super kind to me, actually. In like, because you know how I argue, I'm pretty serious about what I believe, even if it's stupid. So I'm not just going to sit there and not argue back, even if I don't know what's going on. I'm going to fight until I finally get pushed off whatever hill I'm trying to die on. And then hopefully I don't die there and I move to another hill. But
okay, well, perhaps the better question then is, what remained?
Oh, what remained? Okay. I think more or less just like, a raw hatred that brought me to that position almost of really.
But pretty much most anarchist positions, including a class struggle anarchist position, can come out of raw hatred.
I mean, there's plenty but I guess it felt like I had a lot less to do about this. Like when I had a raw hatred for capitalism, it felt like there was some way to
win,
to get out of that situation. Or
you mean by being richer?
No, I mean like for society, like socialism can exist. Like I honestly feel like there will be plenty of large countries, and I could even see at some point like for America or something functioning fine as a socialist country.
Depends on how you define it.
Sure. But so I like that seems more visible. Like when you have like a critique of civilization, it feels like so old, and I felt like so much resentment towards the people that were doing what I do, which is more or less submit to the system. And you know, and to me that seemed like a bigger deal. Like there's not really a way to get around civilization. Like you can shoplift and be like, I'm gonna take that back, because all that stuff is just part of capitalism too, the black market and all that, so you're not really getting around it. But at least you're like a trick yourself a little bit into thinking you're getting around it for a little bit until you realize you're just another fucking person. But for civilization, just felt so much bigger than anything else when I had that. It just felt so monstrous to me.
I mean, this is the funny thing about abstractions, is that abstractions largely are as big as your imagination are.
Yeah.
Because pretty much every abstraction is infinite in size. I mean, capitalism, obviously, it's pretty big.
Oh, it's big.
And you know, clearly we know people who on some level are in a process of self-deceit, that they're somehow outside of it. But they're not.
No, we had you had good points at reading group this week about that. I would say too, about someone was talking about intactivism, or sorry, not.
Like, yes, I was talking about intactivism.
Everyone was talking about, he made some good points about intactivism. And as a Jew, I really felt them strongly, felt them deep. But anyways, so someone, a person that really likes the native lifestyle, how else would you describe it? What word would you use? Okay, anyway.
They're pro-indigenous.
They love the fucking indigenous shit. It's hot. But they were talking about intact tribes, and I was going to say what you said, but you got to it first, and you said that you very succinctly, so Aragorn just told the people at City Group, well, he questioned it by saying, well, there's planes flying over them, there's fucking carbon emissions in the air, like, you know, blah, blah, blah. There's endless amounts of reasons.
Resource extraction.
Endless amounts of reasons that these people have been contacted. And they're not intact. They're compromised or tainted or whatever Zurgin term you want to use for these people. Where are we going with this? I just got lost my train of thought.
Well, that was a pretty good distraction. Oh, God, I've lost my train of thought too.
Because we're intact tribes.
Well, we're really talking about what values remain after AP.
Oh, yeah, that's back a couple steps.
And so we're talking about the abstraction of capitalism or civilization. And you know, really what we're trying to get at, it, and you know, what I'm definitely trying to think about here, what's left, not just from the anarcho-primitivist critique, but, you know, the critique of civilization. And what's left that we should still be thinking about. And I strongly feel that the critique of technology is still the place where that has a lot to offer. That there's something really important there that we're sort of missing.
So yeah,
and really what we're talking about is how technology, perhaps society, cannot exist without technology.
Yeah. So I think that's actually this answers both of the things we were just talking about for me, where it's like a scale difference. So the reason between the anti-capitalist and anti-civ is like, when I anti-capitalist perspective doesn't necessarily include scale, or like I've heard you say this before, human scale. So when I think about anti-Civ, it's literally a difference of billions of people. Mm-hmm. And when I think about anti-capitalism, it's you can still have billions of people. So the size difference is just so big. And then so what remains basically is still that size difference. And I think the most important way I would talk about technology is just the way it interact in effect. It my interpersonal relationships, more or less than anything. Because for an anti-Civ perspective, I guess that's all that's left for me basically of anything. Once I've pulled my scale down to starting with myself and other people I know before even trying to get out beyond that would be like, how do these things affect my life and the people around me? And I don't mean like some, you know, boring way of like the suffocating void where, you know, it's all bad and the light is turning my face into cancer. Like, yeah, like, of course it is. But
I don't know if you knew, if you noticed this week actually was sort of a knee slapper. Kevin, who wrote, who wrote this article, The Suffocating Void, this week. And a big part of the gist of The Suffocating Void is that social media is a suffocating void. And just this week, he paid for a Facebook ad, both selling the the next issue of Black and Green and his new book. And you know, it's like, obviously, we are all hypocrites, and I'm
sure.
But you can still laugh at the.
it's like any addict behavior, right?
You can
sit there all day and say drinking is bad, but you know sometimes you're gonna have a drink. In the same way that KT will talk about Facebook's bad, but like, fuck, man, I really want some people to read my book.
No, for sure.
It's hard to stay relevant when you have a critique. If you want to live your critique of technology, you're just not going to stay relevant, like full on. Like if you have a desire to be relevant, if you have a desire to be heard or read, which are, I don't even know if those are all desires I'm personally fighting with right now, like whether or not I have those desires. Well, I have them, but like how much interest I have in pursuing those desires versus how much I just want to do my own thing for myself. And it's definitely tricky because it means doing some weird shit.
I mean, I'm sure that you realize that your world shrank when you ended Free Radical Radio as a weekly or bi-monthly or whatever event. Your social world, your world went and it really shrank. That said, I do want to give you the one compliment I will give you. Your goodbye letter, I thought it was great. I thought it was really compelling. And if you were going to write more stuff like that, I'd like to read it.
Thanks. Yeah, it was just weird thinking about the whole thing because it wasn't just that. It was like in of close friendships, in like different anarchy thoughts happening.
It was also your goodbye letter to the Bay Area.
Yeah, it was.
Sure, but I mean, so, but almost anything that's meaningful, that's worth reading, is going to be overloaded with stuff going on. I mean, as much as I have written them myself, like, the single issue essay.
Yeah,
I'm not a huge fan. But what I'm saying is that doing this podcast, you know, and obviously part of this podcast is quite obscure.
Yeah.
Part of this podcast is to dance on delicate points rather than positions. You know, there are multiple hundreds of people who are paying attention to this who wouldn't be paying attention if I stopped doing it. And that there is something meaningful there.
That's true. And The other weird part of it for me was like, it's at one point during Free Radical Radio, we were getting 10 emails a week for like weeks on end. And I just can't email my closest friends very often. So I didn't engage in that. And Bellamy had this whole thing where one day he literally sat down, he's like, I'm going to email everyone back that did that. I'm like, great, like go for it. But so for me, there's like something different for me and him in the way that we interacted with things. And maybe like, which is funny because his relationship with technology is probably less than mine. Like this guy can't fucking keep a phone, you know, like in a few years of knowing him, he smashed his phone tons of times and he walked barefoot around fucking ghost town in Oakland for months at a time. Like this shit I'm not going to do, you know, like I don't want to fucking pay for another phone in 3 months when I change my mind. But it's just interesting to think about the way that we related to this super bizarre mediated form of communication with people and what it means like not to have that anymore or something.
Mm-hmm. No, sure.
And
I mean, I'm not saying you should, you know, restart
the podcast. No, of course not.
I'm saying that when you resign, when you stop,
yeah,
it really is a kind of transformation. Obviously, like, you got less feedback, I'm sure, from that goodbye letter than you got from an episode of the podcast. And that's that weird thing where the accessibility of that letter was obviously lower than the accessibility of hearing you talk shit. I mean, a lot of what people liked about you and Bellamy was, you know, I'm way, I talk off mic. I talk shit. and no one, you know, like, obviously one of the reasons why the people who hate me so much is because I talk a lot of shit. Mm-hmm. And on mic, I don't talk very much shit. Yeah. I'm pretty tame. And you were not tame. Like, you talked shit, you named names.
Yeah.
And if it wasn't clear what name you were talking about, like, you know, you did everything but paint the picture. And like, our space doesn't have a lot of that. There's a lot of people who would like to be living in the big sexy cities where the crazy things are happening or whatever, mm-hmm. would like to know all the details.
Yeah.
You know, there's actually a Facebook group right now called Anarchists Against Aragorn Vague Booking, mm-hmm. that basically is just a group of people who like to know the details of the gossip of the things I refer to obliquely.
So what value do you find of, I guess, in Facebook?
Well, it's very similar to what it is that you're talking about in terms of the podcast. I have a variety of projects that I really do want people that are exposed to. And one of the great things about being a publisher, mm-hmm. that is absolutely different than being a writer or whatever, is that I'm plugging and I'm pushing and I'm trying to get people to read other people's stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's stuff I'm excited about, mm-hmm. or have different degrees of excitement about. But like, if I weren't involved, or if I weren't the publisher of Atossa, I would have been interested in it for the couple hours it took for me to read it. Mm-hmm. And then that would have been it for me. But because by being the publisher of it, I sort of had the exciting relationship of wanting to nurture it, of wanting to sort of like understand how it's interfaced with people's lives. And it has. And so Facebook is absolutely a tool to do that in the modern context. If I didn't have Little Black Card as you know, one of my big projects, I'm not sure, like, my Facebook use would go down.
Yeah.
But that would also involve a couple other contingencies, like, I work 40 hours a week and I'm sitting in an office and I have access to a web browser.
Yeah.
So like, that's absolutely part of it.
Totally.
Like, if I worked a 40 hour job, didn't have LV, you know, start to make these weird contortions of like what my life could be in which I wouldn't use Facebook. Because, you know, the strange thing about Facebook, I'm not dealing with my peers on Facebook. I'm mostly dealing with people who are 15 to 20 years younger than me. They wouldn't have an easy way to understand me.
So let's think about this. Like, technology stuff. Mm-hmm. I think you were talking about this last week, and it's something I've been reading about and feel pretty strongly about, is that, like, I don't really love classifying everything into ages, but like, full stop, the internet, like, mm-hmm. it's a whole new society. Like, it's industrial revolution. Like, this might even be bigger. Like, I think it's maybe bigger. And so, like, I think it's important to like think of that context a little bit. So I've been talking to a friend recently, and she's, you know, when people complain about like call out culture and like identity politics, and I'm just using these lazy terms to explain like general stuff. So like, all these anarchists basically, right, who are out there, like someone who is going to post shit on the internet, or right, like the Idlewise pirate lazy garbage that somehow was 80 pages and all this stuff. Like, what would these people look like? And you're probably a better person to ask about this than anyone, because you were in an anarchist space before the internet. So did these people even exist? And, or what did that existence look like for someone with clearly no social skills, whose only ability to be heard is through this megaphone? Because when people do that in person, it does not look the same. Like, these people don't have the social skills. Like, at the LA Book Fair, when people were trying to, I was there when Little Black Car was trying to, they were trying to kick people out or whatever, because I thought it was fucking funny. They don't have the words or the skills to explain what they want.
Right.
They can't say their desire. They can't explain their reasoning. Like, what would it look like? What did it look like when these people didn't have the fucking internet to make them relevant?
Well, before the internet, now, and I can talk about this in great detail, before the internet, there were zines.
Uh-huh.
So the difference between the zine and the internet is the size of the microphone or the megaphone. So I was actually, the last time in my life, or the first time in my life, where I was really called out, uh-huh. it was through zine culture.
What does that mean? Someone wrote like a Aragorn's a bad man zine?
Yeah.
And then what, did they sell it? Did they give it away for free? Like,
sure. Both.
They saw the bad Aragorn scene?
Well, I mean, I was perhaps part of the bad Aragorn.
Oh, it was, yeah, you were one of a number of people in this
thing. No. It would be like a Perzine, okay, where one of the sections would be about...
So would this get to other cities, or would it just be...
For sure, but more pointedly, in that era, like in my particular case, I was called out at a concert, at a fest.
Uh-huh.
And so this is a weekend, you know, and again, like today, people still go to rock and roll concerts, and they even go to like 2 or 3 day festivals, mm-hmm, but they don't necessarily make any friends over the course of that day. They're probably just friends with the people they went with.
Yeah.
And whereas, you know, in the early 90s and the late 80s, like fests were part of the expression of whatever we would call this thing called counterculture, or in other words, you thought the people who were there with you were your community. Whereas I guarantee people at Coachella do not think that these people are part of their community. So in the particular situation I'm talking about, someone stood up on stage and told a first person account of my bad behavior, mm-hmm, to a room of 700 people. So that is an example of like what this particular beast we're calling call-out culture today looked like then.
Was there an ear for it?
You would literally say that someone had been zined.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. But that's you know, really only one baby step from the internet.
Yeah.
Except it did take over 10 years for the internet to really transfer the full energy from that culture. Yeah. But really what you're talking about, you know, is bigger than just this sort of thing.
Yeah, for sure.
The truth is that very few strangers knew that I had been zined. You know, very few strangers knew that this whole thing was happening. But that's sometimes true in what we're talking about on the internet also.
Sure, yeah, sure.
You know, like I go to work and I have this rich and complex life that's happening to me outside of work. And all the people I talk to at work know shit all about it and don't care.
Yeah.
And so there's something in there that is useful, and it's actually one of the nice things about having a job is you, like, you know, my job is one of the few places where I actually get complimented for the work I do.
Uh-huh.
Like, can you, I mean, I've devoted decades of my life to this particular space, and I get very few people saying thank you.
Yeah. I mean, that's not how it works, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, people might have been nicer to me for some reason, which is funny because I feel like I'm just as big of a dick as you are. I somehow fly under the radar sometimes.
You're young.
Yeah, is that what it is?
You do it for 10 more years, you'll...
I don't know. I don't think I have the long... I don't know if I have the longevity I have for you with... In terms of dealing with... I mean, I don't know. I bring this up all the time to enemies I don't find interesting. Like, more interesting enemies, and I think staying engaged in anarchy, like, as it exists as a milieu, or whatever you want to call it, means being engaged with lazy thinking and lazy critics. And, mm-hmm, and like, that's the problem. I was talking about someone as the problem with Atossa right now, and maybe this is an internet problem. Like, I actually didn't think Atossa was that interesting. Mm-hmm. I wanted to like it. I'm one of the people in the world.
You're the target.
I'm fucking primed for this shit. Like, fucking give me that hot shit. And I got it, and I was like, like, it didn't do it for me. It made arguments I didn't like. I mean,
you are the target. I mean, more than almost anyone else, because you've been basically one of the few people to publicly plug ITS.
Oh yeah, which is funny that I rarely get thrown under the bus, because it's kind of amazing. I'm like water off a duck's back with that shit.
I mean, the other thing that sort of makes all of this so laughable, you know, LBC in fact has never published ITS.
Yeah.
Whatever trace, there were some traces in Atossa, but we haven't actually published ITS communiques. In fact, there is a small publisher in Seattle, which you know, in the PNW, all of the most fierce critics of LBC publishing eco-extremism are in the PNW, and they absolutely don't, because of the social capital of the publishers of the publisher of the ITS communiques, the first 10 or something, is in Seattle, and they have absolutely not been accused of the crime.
Oh, the 1 through 8 book or whatever. Yeah. And it's interesting. And that's what I was thinking about when I was thinking about Atossa. I was like, you know, like, I haven't heard one interesting critique of Atossa, because all we're left with is dealing with, like, William Gillis is trash. Like, he's just not that interesting most of the time. He's not that...
And he largely doesn't know what he's talking
about. That's what I'm saying. He's, like, he has some fucking weird idea of history that is living in his crazy mind, like, that no one else, like, that whole platform, who knows what the hell he's talking about. Like,
I mean, I have to give him like, he has no good critics. Like, he clearly surrounds himself with sycophants and idiots.
Yeah, one second of his podcast. When he sounds like a genius compared to the three people on his podcast, yeah, it's fucking gnarly. But what I'm saying is, like, there's no interesting critiques of Atossa right now because, and what are people around your circle doing now? They're critiquing the shitty critiques of Atossa, which is a fucking garbage wormhole. Like, that stuff doesn't deserve the time of day. Absolutely. And that's where I fit under most of this thing, where, like, even when I listen to, like, past Brilliance with you and Bellamy, and it's one of the issues I had on Free Radical Radio, where he wants to respond to everything. I'm like, just because someone says something doesn't mean it's worth responding to. And like,
but the problem with that is that if you shut down those lanes of communication, and I have to say, you know, I'm actually Facebook friends with William Gillis, and obviously tons of toxic stuff, and there's tons of, like, if I wanted to devote my time to responding to everything, you know, I could just spend it on him. But I'm glad that lane is open, because at some point I am going to want to talk about it. At some point, like, so many quote unquote insurrectionary anarchists, which, you know, a whole other conversation is how that term has become perverted to be activism in the US context. But so many insurrectionary anarchists have stopped dialoguing with me, have stopped communicating with LBC for some sort of purity argument, and it's absolutely destroying the North American anarchist space, because basically all it's doing at best is creating islands of similar worldviews, and I don't want that. I absolutely do not want
that. And that's what I was saying to you the other day, where you were telling me about how a bastard a few years ago, they were trying to, people with different perspectives were trying to talk. This is before I ever came in the space. And I'm like, that's what I want. Like, I want to be like, you're a transhumanist? That's some crazy bullshit. Let's fucking talk about it. Like, instead of being like, you're a horrible person, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, yeah, I am a horrible person, but, like, why do we need to talk about that? That's boring. Like, that's for a fucking therapist. Like, that's not for this conversation. Like, who cares?
Well, but this is, you know, one of the reasons why that doesn't happen, or why that's happening less and less frequently. Like, that's not healthy. That's the problem is that ultimately, speaking for myself, I want complexity, and I want anarchism to sort of represent a complicated worldview. And I'm not so interested in it winning. And there are, I mean, I feel like 75% of the anarchist space, it befuddles me to even say this out loud, but 75% of the anarchist space seems to think that there's a chance we could win, and that all their energy is devoted to winning. Therefore, they're absolutely uninterested in what it is that I would like to do, because they're so goddamn concerned about winning.
And I harp on you for this all the time, where I think that number is higher. And I, I mean, I think you started when you had this conversation maybe a couple years ago, you were like, nah, it's only like 25%. And now you've come up to 75. And I'm still on 99%.
I don't actually believe, I believe it's 75% of the vocal anarchists have this perspective. I don't believe that the vast majority of anarchists like this.
Yeah.
But who wants to fight it? Who wants to be in the position that I'm in all the fucking time?
Well, that's what Free Radical Radio was fighting this concept and all the time, and fighting it directly, like talking about things that those people are doing all the time and breaking it down. And that's why we got so many emails. So I think the 25% or the people that you're talking about, maybe this latent, interested, interesting person that wants something more, like that's who emailed us. Like that's who was like, sure, I'm living in like some little town, or I'm living in Olympia and I'm surrounded by trash people who, if I ever said anything I thought out loud, would lynch me. And
it's funny you mentioned Olympia in that context, because of course, you know, some of the harshest critiques of us have come out of Olympia. But I tell you, there's a solid half dozen people who reach out to me all the time, mm-hmm, basically like looking for a lifeline, looking for something other than the trash that's in their neighborhood.
Yeah.
But it's extremely difficult. Like, by and large, the only way to win in those situations, and, you know, this is advice for fucking the youth, is you have to outlast them. Most of my harshest political rivals, I've outlasted.
But does it matter that you've outlasted them if more just pop up, like if it's a garden full of weeds growing against you?
Well,
you know?
Yes, absolutely it matters.
Okay.
Because basically, you know, if you just take Redneck Revolt as an example, right? Uh-huh. Now, on some level, I don't care. If you want to cosplay that you're a redneck with guns at lefty events or at gun shows.
You mean if you want to wear a Kevlar vest to a black neighborhood at the LA Anarchist Book Fair as some skinny ass white person?
If you want to do that, that's fine. Yeah. Like, that's fine. But obviously, the concept of what it is that they're doing is that, by and large, it has a sort of class struggle orientation that says that the class is racialized in America, and we as woke white people...
Revolutionary subject.
We want to be engaged with the revolutionary subject, and this is, you know, this is how we're performing that particular sort of relationship. That stuff is weak on every... like level that you can describe something as being weak, but it's not that big of a deal because it's probably not going to last its, you know, second year of existing. It's totally bogged down in controversy and in its own inadequacy and in its own lack of complex thinking about its own activity. You compare that to AK Press, right? Those people are not my rivals. Their youth is what they are. And their youthful way of thinking about their own project is part of the definition of what it is that they are. AK Press is much more my rival. And that's because AK Press has been doing what it is that they're doing as long as I've been doing what it is that I've been doing. And they have their perspective is mature and complicated. And they can basically say that they're doing several different things at once. And I guess I would say that, like, it's important to sort of understand that there is a difference. Like, sure, people might be talking about Redneck Revolt and the dramas of the day might be about them, but they're, in the scheme of things, they don't matter that much. And maybe they'll matter in 10 years, but not today. Whereas AK Press, you know, they just published a couple books that are absolutely interesting because they're in a space that I would sort of like us to be talking about. They're just about to do a brand new book that is somewhere in the space of black, aka African-American anarchists talking about their own experience. You know, I would absolutely love to have published a book like that, not by these authors.
Right.
You know, like in other words, AK Press, they get 25% right all the time. How many other groups get even that much right? You know, Redneck Revolt is not 25% right. They're like maybe 5%. They have
some. At best. They like guns.
Yeah.
Fuck yeah. Like, load it up. And then that, I don't know. I guess it's, I'm thinking about too in terms of like how long do these like fads last and what does it mean to have like an anarchy without fads? Is that even possible? Like, absolutely. Like, so, but okay. So
anarchism is not a fad.
I don't mean anarchy is a fad. Okay. So what, I guess what I'm talking about is like, when I first came to Oakland, like everyone in the world, it seemed all they cared about was police brutality, right? Like every demo was organized around that. And it's not like black people stopped getting shot the last 2 years.
But you're talking about activism. Activism necessitates fresh blood, necessitates faddish behavior.
So I guess.
But with all that said, we are now at about an hour.
Okay.
Do you want to share some closing thoughts about technology and your feelings about this conversation?
I feel like we didn't talk about technology that much.
It's true. It was hard to keep it focused. And that is actually something that's worth saying. I actually, you know, obviously I agree with it because it echoes something you've heard me say recently. But I feel like the conversation around technology versus the conversation around the internet is an incredible distinction that is a new one.
Yeah, I guess without wanting to get into like a technical conversation of all the bad things that happen with technology, with the big things, which are obvious, and trying to keep on the level of like your life and your projects, it's still hard to talk about, and it's still, but like part of that anti-civ thing that remains for me is still when I'm in a room with three of my friends and they're all on their phones, I'm just like, what's the point?
What the fuck is this about?
Yeah. What's the fucking point? Like, it's like almost an anarchist thing too, where like when someone's an anarchist and doesn't want to share their fucking food with me or something, I'm like, this, just like all the fucking small shit like that. Like phones is the one thing that fucking gets me where I'm like, do you not care about this? Like what the fuck is on there? Just, I don't know.
But you're basically of the age where the phone break happened, meaning that you probably, your teenage years, you probably still didn't have a cell phone.
I didn't have a cell phone. Yeah, no. And even when I was in college, most of my friends didn't have cell phones. Like, right. I don't know if that, for what reason that was, but it was not normal. It wasn't like everyone had a phone.
Well, it was still quite expensive.
Yeah, that's what it was, I guess.
Well, thank you very much for having us. Actually, I'll bring you on for future topics because obviously you always have opinions.
Cool. Thanks, everyone.
Sometimes they're amusing.
Sometimes.